Well, welcome everyone. We're just a couple minutes behind because of technical difficulties, but that is no big deal at all. We are excited tonight as our first inaugural meeting with an expert. Dr. Melissa Sadin joins us for Team R&R to talk about finding hope for resilience and recovery. And I am going to do an introduction of Dr. Sadin. She is a published author and educational consultant. She's an advocate for trauma-informed schools. She has produced numerous webinars on the topic and written many books. She holds two master's degrees and a doctoral degree in developmental trauma in schools. She's just a lifelong educator and adoptive parent, speaker, author, national expert. I could go on and on. I'm lucky enough to call her a good friend. So welcome, Dr. Sadin.
Thank you. You forgot to say lifelong dear friend of ATN as well.
Yes, in fact. Yeah, well, we could go down a rabbit hole there and maybe you'll kind of talk a little bit about that. But yeah, the Attachment and Trauma Network has really been shaped and molded, especially our Trauma Sensitive Schools Conference and program by Dr. Sadin. And we're so grateful for that. So lifelong friend for sure. So I wanna be mindful of everyone's time and dive right in. Why did you choose this kind of topic? Like, let's start out talking about what you feel is the current state of education kind of post-pandemic. Why do we even need to talk about resilience and recovery? As I laugh, you know, because my gosh, it's been the hardest school year ever, but I want to get your take on that.
You know, it's interesting. You think you've hit like the hardest part of your life or the hardest part of your job, and then it gets harder and you realize that what you thought was the hardest part really isn't so bad. And I definitely think are feeling, oh, wait, that whole year where the kids were away from us and we were trying to work out of our homes and learn how to teach remotely was the worst ever, and that it would all be better when everybody got back in school. And I think part of what's going on, there are a number of things going on in our beloved profession right now. And one of them is that people were, I think, very shocked by that that's not what happened. So the relief that they were so needing and looking for was not there. So, you know, you started to ask, you know, why this topic? And so this topic is the answer to that question as well. Resilience, as I define it, is the ability to adapt to changes in your environment and to overcome challenges, shortened adapt and overcome. And if you really think of, I mean, really think about that. So your haircut appointment is canceled and you're about to do a keynote speech, right? So if you have resilience, that might really stink. But you either develop a new hairstyle or use a lot of hairspray, but out you go, right, to deliver this keynote speech. Growing up with my dear son, Theo, who has pretty significant developmental trauma, watching him have absolutely no inherent skills to do that. And I'm talking like, you know, the soccer game was canceled. We'll get to, you know, oh, there's a pandemic. But resilience can be measured in small ways as well as big ways. And teachers, educators actually have a wonderful sense of resilience once they start to think about it that way. Mm-hmm. Children who might, I don't know, screw around in the classroom, throw a pencil, and you kind of look at them like,
oh, she's frozen. Is she frozen on your end as well?
You know, Demi.
Okay, we'll keep going. You froze a little bit there. Sorry.
Continue. That's okay. I can't control the internet. I don't know what the problem is. So, you know, we might be thinking, you know, Timmy, really, you're going to throw a pencil? That's not what you say, of course, but Timmy can see that in your face. And Timmy's immediately sorry, and he picks the pencil up, and, you know, you probably don't see that behavior in him again. Resilience. He thought throwing the pencil was going to be fun because he's an impulsive little boy, but then realized that that was not such a good idea, and he wants to please the teacher, so, you know, that's enough. Children who do that are resilient. Theo throws a pencil, or other children. He's the poster child for developmental trauma, so I will use him as an example. But so Theo throws the pencil, and you make this, you know, Theo, really, we're going to throw a pencil? That look on your face, he's destroyed.
Mm.
He's completely destroyed because you don't love him and he's unworthy. Absolutely. His whole world explodes over the throwing of a pencil. And then the recovery takes a visit to the counselor or possibly escalates. Now he's like, this class is stupid anyway. And out of the class, he storms. And it really just started with a look on your face. Resilience is that ability to adapt. Now, the defining piece, though, is it doesn't mean you don't still struggle, but that you adapt. And then hopefully as you grow, sometimes you overcome in the next minute, sometimes you overcome in the next 5 years. Okay, so if you think about yourself first, are you resilient? Do you adapt? I have yet to find an educator in my career who wasn't resilient because the technology is a perfect example. Your whole lesson's going to be on your smart board, your Promethean board, and it's broken. There's no light bulb in it. The AV guy's gone. So there you go. And you got to wing it, make it up. That's resilience. Okay. So now, Bruce Perry once told me that the most traumatizing thing about trauma events, experiences really, because it's not the event, it's the experience, is that loss of control and power over the event. And so if you think about environmental adverse experiences, you can't stop the tornado. If you think about family dysfunction, the 8-year-old child can't make mom fight her addiction. The 16-year-old child can't repair the damaged relationship of the parents, the fighting, the yelling. So we entered a pandemic where we all lost control of things like the supply chain, toilet, and the inability to predict. And that is traumatizing for all of us by degrees. Now, the more resilient you are, you're like, okay, so what am I going to grow in the backyard that I'm going to be able to use as toilet paper? And then I had other friends who were consumed, for example, right, by, oh my God, like I have to drive 86 miles. I'm going to do everything I can to get more toilet paper.
Mm.
So now that's happened to all of us. And my basic premise to teachers, one size fits one, as you know, Ginger, is one of my favorite things to say. But because we have to run a whole school full of a whole lot of kids, we have to draw some lines in the sand, in addition to keeping in mind one size fits one. And what I tell the teachers that I work with is, if you thought there was ACEs present, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, before the pandemic, things didn't get better.
Yeah.
So yet, if you had resilient kids, they might look different to you right now, but they should adapt and overcome with good care. So now I'm out there preaching to boards of education and superintendents anytime I can chase one into an elevator and lock them there, to explain that teachers need the same grace.
Mm.
And so I talk a lot about resilience and recovery, right? First, am I resilient? Because here's the beauty of resilience. If you're not, you can go get some. And I have to give a shout out to my friend, Dr. Andy Fetzner, and her group at originstraining.org. If you want to find out if you're resilient, if you're still unsure, you can certainly go to originstraining.org and take the survey. Because the other thing that happens to even resilient teachers is compassion fatigue. I think compassion fatigue might be increased in times where you have loss of control. And so the people who are, you know, at the highest levels of leadership in our system, superintendents, boards of education, boards of directors, et cetera, have a tremendous amount of pressure to fix. It all has to go back. And they also mistakenly thought, well, we're going to hit the ground running in September and we're all just going to, you know, I close the gap of learning, which I hate to talk about because I say, no, it's the new normal. It's where the kids are now. And we have to stop racing to fix what's not broken. And of course, they know exactly that that's the pressure falls directly on them. And they don't have the power or the control to do anything about it. So then we have to talk about recovery. You know, and I worked with a group of folks in Toledo last weekend. And, you know, I took them all out to lunch. I told the person who hired me and I said, I'm canceling the rest of the training today. And she was like, well, you know, they have to have so many hours. I said, I'll sign the form. These people are unwell. And, you know, I said, would you try to give a math quiz to a hungry child? She's like, of course not. I said, well, stop trying to give a math quiz to 100 bunks of adults. They need time. They need care. They need you to change what you think is going to get done in a year so that they can have more control. And I've always been a big fan of the growth mindset. You know, where are we now? And so you measure every child where they are right now, benchmark, and then you measure the growth in June. And then that's what you hand your administrator. This is the growth. Instead of, you know, here's an artificial line in the sand that everybody has to reach. And then, you know, literally and figuratively whipping the teachers until they make it happen. And, you know, these teachers that I took out to lunch, said, you know, well, you know, my favorite, well, we're powerless. Okay, I heard a saying the other day. I hope I get it right. I'm going to paraphrase it because it was really brilliant. Set yourself on fire with your passion because people will come from miles around to watch you burn. If you have passion for your beliefs and you hold to them, people will come. So yeah, the interesting part of that is they're not watching you suffer burn. They're watching the brilliance of your passion.
Yeah.
So I say to teachers, you know, in states where there are unions, some of the unions are statewide, even standing up and just saying, you know, we're not going to administer any standardized tests. You can't make us. And the unions are in those states have tremendous political lobbying power. So they are, but there are so many states without that kind of union presence. And there are schools, I worked in one for a number of years within a unified state that did not have unions. And so, you know, that superintendent certainly could have, you know, used the whipping post methodology and, you know, didn't. So if we don't stand up and say, we can't do what we did before. We learned how to build an airplane in the sky while we were trying to fly last year. We can do this too, but this is the wave hitting the shore. And so it's going to take five years. And anybody who thinks that the new normal will be, the dust will be settled before 5 years is wrong and needs to be stopped. because sometimes that's the people in leadership. Recovery. I was doing, putting together a PowerPoint today for a group called The Science of Happiness and Hope. And I love to do research on hope because that's just a lovely thing. The number one thing I can tell you about hope is that the more you say the word, the more you actually will demonstrate the hormone reaction of a person who has hope. So when people say, I don't have time, I don't have money, I don't have the power, you can say the word hope. You can say it 16 times a day. You can get silly and challenge yourself to work it into like every other sentence you say, because the science is clear that when you say hope, you have hope. And then guess what? When you say hope and have hope, the people around you have hope. And they specifically did a number of studies. And EdWeek has picked up this mantle, which makes me very happy because they're great at like sweeping national surveys. That the teachers who use the word hope have classrooms that are more hopeful. And then guess what hope is? To swing it all the way back around, it's resilience.
Yes, hope, resilience is the science of hope.
So I was writing what I now call the four building blocks of hope. Just making this stuff up today, I really was. I had a really great cup of coffee this morning. Out it came. So, and it's all tight. All of this, Ginger, you'll recognize it too. And any of the folks who are here with us tonight who've done any work on PACE's connection or with Ann Folletti's work or any of that will know that this all is the same, because the way to heal from adverse childhood experiences is relationships, getting relationships with others, learning to trust, right? And volunteering, finding something you're good at. If you're not comfortable with other people, then go do something for you, right? Become a book reader, become a skier, right? Things you don't have to do with other people. So one of my building blocks of hope is go volunteer, go do something for other people. And the other one, one of the other ones, I don't even know if I can remember all four because the coffee wore off somewhere around two. But the other one was, of course, you know, self-care, finding a regulation tool. People all say, I walk or I hike. I don't mean to make light of those things. They're wonderful. But here it is, because you know I'm never far from it. But what do you do? What do you do all day long? You know, if you're waiting, people say, well, you know, I go to Aruba with my husband once a year. Fabulous. That's great for so many things. I'm sorry, but that's not daily self-care, because you should not be waiting 360 days for the five where you're going to rest. And so finding tools that fill your brain with serotonin that you can do in the middle of being told that you have to change your student growth outcomes because they're insufficient. You will survive that with a better physical outcome if you find something that you love, like a glitter wand or silly putty. Or people have so many wonderful things now. I'm just a diehard fan of this gigantic silicone sponge that I found at Home Goods.
Yeah, I've heard you talk before about daily self-care and breaking it down into micro and macro, and that was a good delineation for me, because I tended to look at it from, you know, just this narrow point of view. I hadn't thought of micro and macro examples. I don't know if you want to kind of go over that a little bit.
Macro self-care is anything you do with your whole body. Generally, I say it takes more time, but it doesn't have to. You know, you can do 10 minutes of yoga. So I'm not saying it has to take an hour, but basically, I say, hopefully it's things you're doing without being on your phone, right? Riding a bike, boy, I hope you're not scrolling through Facebook on your bike. But it doesn't have to be like Peloton, joining a gym, high impact, high aerobic. You know, if you're sitting here going, I'm just even too tired to start, because everybody always says the more you work out, the more energy you have. But I've been there, and that very first step can seem insurmountable. But so macro self-care is anything. And I love to tell the story of Jeannie, who stood up when I was explaining macro self-care in one of my trainings. And she said, I paint. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, I guess, you know, canvas, that's very good. The colors, it's art, any kind of art's very good for your brain. And she goes, no, I paint the interior walls of houses. I was like, oh, that's different. So she explained, because she had figured out that this was good for her. You know, and if you've ever had the pleasure of painting inside of a house, you got to cut it in. So that's a lot of reaching and bending and stretching and taping. And then there's the roller, which is very soothing and rhythmic. And also, you know, who needs squats when you, you know, hand rolling a room? And the other thing she said was, nobody bothers you. You got a paintbrush in your hand, poof, your family's gone. Like, no one wants to be invited to help. So she puts on stories, podcasts, music, and loses herself in the color and the job. And so she's always looking for a room to paint. She's not allowed to paint in her own room. She said, this is her joke. My husband said that the rooms are all getting smaller because the walls are so thin. So my point is, that was genius, because she found something that many people would find abhorrent, but she understood that it was her working out. Some people like to clean. Like if you have a split level house, or even, you know, just a significantly sized house, and this is my thing, I like to clean from start to finish. Like I chase everybody out and I just get going. So I'm waxing and I'm buffing and I'm vacuuming, right? So that's good, Paul. And then you're going up and down the stairs. It's cardiovascular. Yeah. And I love it because at the end, you can instantly see your progress. So macro self-care is not only hiking, walking, yoga, which swimming, any of those things are great. And if you're doing them, that's fabulous. But don't forget to look at something you look forward to doing that actually requires your whole body that others might consider a chore. And then micro self-care is where mindfulness meets this work. So if you meditate, if you know how to sit still for 30 seconds, the other thing I tell my tired, overworked teacher friends, particularly those with toddlers, Ginger, remember those years? You're just barely coming out of them. So that was where you just, you know, lose the opportunity to be alone, even in the bathroom.
Yep.
And so then all of a sudden you look up, usually because your husband's come in from being out with real people in the world, and you realize you haven't showered for 4 days. So aside from those very difficult, trying years, most of us shower or bathe, and pretty regularly in this country. So I say to those people who, again, want to tell me time and money, those are the reasons that I don't do any of this. If you can stand in the shower, spread your toes out on your shower pan or tub so you're standing up nice and straight. And then count one Mississippi. You got to use the Mississippis or you'll cheat. And just focus on the water. When it comes down over your ears, you can't hear your children screaming. So that's a good thing. And you just say one Mississippi, two Mississippi, I have to get milk. One Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi, four Mississippi, I'm so mad at my husband. One Mississippi, two. You will get better at it. Then you'll give up like somewhere around five Mississippis the first time. Oh, I can't do this. But if you just keep trying, I have people who come back after, like, I've seen them 2 years. I got to 30 and it was just last week. The point of what you do for the chemistry of your brain by trying is as good as running a marathon, which I don't recommend if you're not in shape, because then that's just torture. But there are lots of ways to get this mindfulness into your life. But if you keep doing what you've always done, I mean, it's okay to say, well, I can't control the board. Okay, you can control counting in the shower. Remember what Bruce Perry told me. You have to find the control in your life.
Yeah.
And if it's not in your classroom anymore, even though it was, adapt, overcome. Because I'm begging teachers not to leave.
Yeah.
If they can stay, if they're well enough to stay, because I have two of my dearest, closest teacher friends, I even supported their needing to leave. The pandemic was too hard on them. And you know, they're trying to heal from their trauma. And that just takes a long time. And then working in a place that has become toxic is not going to support that healing. But to most, I say, the pressures that you're under are going to ease. And you can start self-care among your staff without anybody's permission.
I love that, because I'm hearing all the time from educators how exhausted they are, how drained they are, how defeated they feel. And I have so much, you know, sympathy for that. But like you said, like, we don't want to stay stuck there. So what can we do? Where do we go from here? And you've given some really practical examples of self-care. What do you think, like, as an administrator, you could do for the teachers and educators in the building? What would you recommend in that regard?
If you have the big one, the hardest one, I'll say that one first, is to push back or to ask questions at your admin council meeting. What if, you know, can I have time to? And then, you know, inside your building where you do have some ability to make things happen as a building administrator, do a faculty meeting where you tell everybody about macro and micro self-care, and you get everybody a self-care buddy. They can pick their own, and you can't have more than three people as buddies. So if there's a group of eight folks who are good friends, they have to decide who's their one buddy. And then I had everybody make a self-care plan. Mm-hmm. And they didn't hand it in to me or anything. And some people shared at the end. That was the meeting. Leaders, I beg you, less is more. Mm-hmm. If there was a time when that was the only way to survive, it's now. If you need to give people all kinds of information, put it in an email and tell them they're responsible for reading your emails. And if they don't, when they don't know something, you say, I'm sorry, you didn't read the email, but I'm doing it in the email so that when we're together, I don't have to stand in front of you and read off a whole bunch of stuff where six of you start to fall asleep and three of you are playing Candy Crush. Understandably, I've been there. Falling asleep, 3 o'clock, it's a tough time. So then, you know, my point was, then you talk about it and you get people laughing, and then you do a happiness challenge where you come up with 30 different days. A group of teachers I worked with came up with this. I didn't have this brilliant idea. And they emailed it to everybody, but they put it by the copier and the sign in places where people physically go. And it was things like read a book and fly a kite and walk your dog. And so at the end of the month, we would just have a meeting where people would share how you're doing on your self-care, share that just with your self-care buddy. And of course, if you want to stand up and, oh, somebody made something, adult entertainment, if you will, mm-hmm. one of their care act, they wanted to increase the amount of adult entertainment that they had. So he stood up and was very happy to share with all of us. So now we're all laughing, and laughing also changes your pheromone balance. And heals. And so as a school leader, you don't need more money and you don't need a whole PD day to just eke in these things. Mm-hmm. A lot of principals have done this, canceled faculty meetings. They meet once a month for 20 minutes. And I keep saying, for what? So you can list off a bunch of stuff, trust them to be the adults that they are. And then I had one principal go, well, there's so many emails. I'm like, well, how many of them are yours? Because if you're sending 86 emails a day, then you have to figure out how to communicate with people better and compress it so they actually read your emails when you send them. So there's a lot there that's good leadership practice. And I would just say to my teachers, I'm trying to increase self-care. And then, of course, you have to model it. Mm-hmm. The only group of people in greater danger of leaving this profession than teachers is the school leaders, because they're leaving in faster amounts than the teachers.
Wow. And I think I'll never forget one time you told me, I was asking you, like, you know, how do I help the kids? And you said, take care of the principal, then she'll take care of the teachers, then the teachers will take care of the kids. And it was such a paradigm shift for me, you know.
And that's what, that's my whole, all the way back to my first story. You know, I said, I turned and said to this, she was actually a curriculum director last week. And I said, well, you know, you're doing such a great job of feeding everybody anytime, all day long. And they were talking about like their plans for Meals on Wheels that the school's going to sponsor all summer long. So kids are fed, there's backpacks for the weekends. So nobody's hungry. And I said, look at what you've done. And then you don't recognize that your own teachers are quote unquote starving. Mm-hmm. And she later sent me an email and thanked me for, you know, putting on the right glasses.
Yeah. And,
you know, it's just, she was all hysterical that I was going to cancel a training 4 hours ahead of time. And I was like, and, you know, did you see the looks on their faces? And what did we do? But come on, you know, I paid for lunch so we could all sit at a big table and do what? Talk about trauma-informed teaching. So we were discussing, which teachers know is the best way to make sure kids are learning material, is that they can use it in a conversation and then expand on it, Bloom's taxonomy. So there we were. And they were analyzing and synthesizing, you know, their way right on up Bloom's. And I was thrilled. By the end of lunch, I felt like this group might have learned the most from my, you know, including the ones that had a lot of liquid with their lunch.
Yeah. That is so powerful though, because yeah, you still got the message across, but they felt seen and heard.
Yep. You're clever, but the reason people don't take care of themselves, self-care, micro, macro, is they have lots of excuses, but at the end of the day, they either don't believe they're worthy, or have the guts to say stop, right? So, you know, one of the things that ATN, I tell people all the time that finding ATN saved my life, because my husband and I were fighting terribly. Theo was just destroying the house, literally and figuratively. And one of the first conversations that I had with some of you, they said, well, you know, when's the last time you and Andrew went out? And of course, who can get a babysitter for this little maniac kid? You can't leave him with, you know, I can't even leave him with my mother because that's just too mean. And he, of course, would escalate when I would leave the house. So dear Stephanie Gard says, well, go out separately together. I'm like, what? And they were like, well, one of you stay behind and the other one goes. And we started this tag team dating without going out with each other. We were nicer to each other. I started going out to dinner with a dear friend, and we're still going out to dinner, you know, at least once a month. And my husband started bowling. Turns out he didn't even know he liked bowling. And now he's on the U.S. Men's Senior Open Tour.
Oh my gosh.
So I kept going with my friend and he kept bowling, but sometimes I bowl with him and sometimes we actually go out to dinner together now. But the point you were all making to me was this whole thing of, if you don't save yourself, then how can you save Theo or your other child or your marriage or anything else?
Yeah.
And so I say to all of you, do you really? Because you can give me 80 million reasons and they might all be true for why you can't count to 30 in the shower or find a self-care buddy. But I told this group of teachers, you're all miserable. And I don't want to lose you because you're great educators. And if you keep doing what you've always done, then if you end up leaving this profession, that's on you.
Mm.
Except for the, you know, rare cases where it truly has become very toxic for some folks. And then I say, you know, make sure you're really taking care of you. And if that means finding a different place to work, then that's your answer. So I don't want anybody who might be thinking about leaving to feel bad. As long as you're really doing it because you know it's best for you, then you're doing the right thing. But that's that whole thing of having the courage to say to little Theo, mommy's going to go out now with her friend, screaming, yelling, grabbing him on my leg, you know, and then poor Andrew. Because when Andrew left, Theo was fine with me. But when I left, he exploded and my husband hung in there. And then what did I do but realize that's how much he loved me? You know, literally taking the spitting and the biting. And it wasn't like that every time, but, you know, and then that became the cursing. And it didn't happen to me when he left. So I saw him in a whole new light and what he was willing to do to save his family. And, you know, healing happened from there. So I've been in really, really rough places. And no, the pandemic's a new one on me too. But what I know is that I'm resilient. And the adapting and overcoming is your job, not anybody else's. Nobody else can adapt for you or overcome for you.
Well, and I really like what you said. I mean, I don't like it that recovery is going to take 5 years, but when you did say that, it gave me permission to not be so hard on myself or others, and made me think, okay, then I've got to adjust expectations here.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if anybody on the call is familiar with Katrina. You know, some hurricanes are like Cher and Madonna. They just have one name and everybody knows, but just completely destroyed most of New Orleans. And particularly most of the impoverished and under-resourced wards, because they were in the lowest lying areas. So if you know anything about New Orleans, you know that they're still in the middle of their 15-year rebuilding plan. So the smartest thing that mayor did was say, let's make it, and people like 15 years building homes, growing grass. It takes a long time. So this isn't as visible as the damage by a tornado or a hurricane, but it's not any less real.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think at first, you know, there's those stages, like we were in shock and then we were in denial. And now, you know, yeah, there's, and I think you've said this to me too, that like, there's no rush to resilience,
you know?
So let's sit in that and deal with what we can deal with and get control where we can. And, you know, at least for me tonight, I'm taking away this thought of, this is that big that it's going to take time. So give yourself that grace and, you know, do what you can do.
Yep. I had a friend who has actually, you know, in my humble opinion, a pretty darn good principal. He has a lot of great leadership talent and is getting a lot of pressure from his caring, but also pressured from the State Department Board of Education. You know, I don't want to set people up in leadership as being, you know, evil or ogres in any way. So even this great guy has not been himself, but the pandemic happened to him too.
Mm-hmm.
His kids got very sick and, you know, so, right. So she finally just, you know, said to me, in this state, they're required to submit SGOs, student growth. Most teachers do, but they're called all different things. And so the idea is that you get the baseline that I was talking about, but then you have to move them to this artificial line. And the artificial line is much higher now because the kids are in a different place. And so I finally just said to her, and she was very stressed, and she, you know, reached out to me, and I said, you're a great teacher. Teach the kids, not the baseline. And at the end of the year, you hand them what you've done as your best. Your kids are going to move farther if you teach them. And at the end of the day, you know, he's not going to fire you.
Yeah.
And if he's disappointed in you, then that's a good opportunity for you to say, I'm so sorry that you're under this pressure, you know, to create what can't be done.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's, you know, just like I said, you got to stand up for yourself, and you can do it without being, you know, disruptors unite next week.
Yeah.
But, and I'm a big fan of, you know, going right at the windmill, you know, with my horse and my armor, but I have learned that there are lots of ways, to stand up for yourself, and they don't have to be conflict, and they don't have, but you have to support yourself and say, I'm good at this, and I'm going to love my kids, and I'm going to help them heal. And by the way, learning and focusing on reading, that's a really wonderful respite for these kids too. So the lessons themselves and the community that you set in your classroom, all of these things are healing, but it's not just everybody's like, oh, the first 6 weeks and they're, no, it's going to, you know, the first 6 years.
Yeah.
We need to take that great pedagogy of the first 6 weeks set out for us by Responsive Classroom, if you're not familiar, and kind of make that the next 2 years.
Mm. Well, and we know, I also learned from you that students can't learn until they are safe, regulated, and connected. So we got to go back to that too, that the academics will come, you know, different for every child, who knows when and where, but that those things have to be in place first. So.
And your most fragile kids, teachers know this, your most fragile kids don't do well when you're not there.
Hmm.
And they don't do well when, you know, you're frustrated and short-tempered and all those things that we all are some days. But what I am hearing is, you know, I'm short-tempered most days, and then I go home and just feel bad, and then, you know, this spiral, and then you snap at your kids, and it's really toxic stress hormones of cortisol. We all have cortisol sickness. Volunteerism changes the balance of cortisol in your body. Just saying, going all the way back.
Yeah, saying, I love that.
Saying the word hope, you know.
Yeah, and I loved that you pointed out that it's contagious.
Yeah, that's the funnest part.
Yeah, that is, because I've also, you know, been learning that, you know, chaos is contagious, but calm mm-hmm. is contagious. Hope is contagious. So swinging that pendulum the other way. I want to give our listeners on this call, if you guys have questions or comments, you can put them in the chat, or you can come off mute and ask a question. You know, we would love that as well. So let me know. I knew time would go fast, Melissa. We can talk all night.
I know. I was not worried. Plus, you know how I am. You know, you push me and I start rolling.
Yeah.
Just need to start, and then there's no stopping me.
Yeah. Well, we don't have any comments quite yet, but I was just looking over my notes. I didn't want to forget anything that you said either. I like what you said about, like, remembering your passion or why you got into this, like knowing your why, you know, because it's so easy to forget when you get tired and drained and, you know, you're pouring from an empty cup. You forget.
Yes. And for so many, this isn't just educators, but for people who are not familiar with the toxic stress symptoms that come with trauma, they have varying degrees of it in this post-pandemic, but is it really post? I don't know. In this new time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just keep saying to people, you know, we just spent all morning talking about, you know, adverse experiences and the impact of trauma on kids. Are you finding it hard to focus? Are you saying, you know, my goodness, I'm 38 years old. Why is my memory so terrible all of a sudden? Are you? Okay, that's high levels of cortisol. And just because you think that, you know, you're not necessarily akin to adverse childhood experiences, those are the folks who are not recognizing that they have more of a post-traumatic syndrome from the pandemic, from worrying about toilet paper. And even now, anybody who's trying to get anything done, as my husband and I are in our new beach condo, 6 to 8 weeks. Nail, 6 to 8 weeks. You need new windows, 6 to 8 weeks. You need a new mattress because you're sleeping on a torture device, 10 weeks. And it's, you know, sometimes I just wanna yell. So I go down to the beach and I yell and then I let it go because I can't make the mattress get here any faster. So you got to name the monster to tame the monster. And that's, I have found, the greatest gift to give teachers. Give them time to say, wait a minute, what happened to me? Yeah. What do I feel? These very subtle things. Every once in a while I'm in the food store, I can't remember what I went for. Or things that's me all the time. But if that's new for you, they don't have to be these huge sweeping crises of depression or anxiety for you to still be bearing the physical remnants of what happened to you over the last 2 years. Mm. Grace in the space.
Mm. Yeah. No, there is a lot of ways for us to burn that cortisol. And I think it's really helpful to acknowledge that, you know, we're not just talking about the kids, we're talking about the teachers, we're talking about the givers, we're talking about all of us that, you know, especially those who are helping others, that they've got to help themselves first, you know.
Everybody wants to know, you know, how are we going to recover? The boards, teachers, how are we going to recover? Taking care of the people who run the school, teachers, administrators, custodians. If you take care of them, then we all get better as a society. But if you're trying to, you know, well, we have that one workshop, so, you know, I'm crossing that off my list, we're done with self-care. That's like, you know, for people who truly do have clinical depression, they could tell you what one day of therapy does not a cure make.
Yeah.
And it's the same, you know, honestly, you know, I got very sick with COVID. Boy, you know, talk about one day and a couple of pills does not make that better. Broken bones, right? So why are we all of a sudden in such a big hurry? And I think it's because we're afraid. We're afraid to honor it because it might come back.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to read this comment because I think it is so good. Carol says, I wonder if the fact that the future of the virus's course is still unknown makes this all harder.
That, where do you go? No. The unknown, yes. And my friend is a virologist. I just thought she worked in a lab before this. And then she started knowing things about like the COVID virus and what it wasn't going to do. And, you know, we were watching TV separately together a year and a half ago, and they're talking. She's like, no, that's not true. No. And I'm like, wow. So she actually then went and volunteered for the CDC. So she knows a lot scientifically, and the truth of it. And I only say this by way of so that you can give yourself grace. I don't want to scare anybody with the truth, which is this is new normal. Because this virus broke the boundaries of what we used to call a pandemic. And it spread in a way that only our current culture could allow, the ability for not just very wealthy people to get on a plane, how quickly people move from one place to the other, not just within the contiguous continental United States, but how easily people from Bangladesh and Kapoor and Thailand and you know, they can all move around and communicate with each other. And so sharing the common cold is not confined to the people in your house or your classroom anymore. And that's not gonna, you know, you can't put that monkey back in the barrel.
Yeah.
It will have different names, and it will or won't have such devastating physical impacts as this one did, you know, on so many very old and very young people. But instead of like SARS or, you know, I can remember, I'm of an age where I remember, you know, it just was happening to somebody else. There was a big problem in Africa. There was a big problem in Taiwan. It was a big, and it was always somebody else's problem. You know, Ebola, not my problem, right? And so this one, you know, jumped all the ponds. And we can learn a lot from people in Africa and South Africa and some of the countries in Asia who have had these things happen 3 or 4 times before. And again, we're learning things. We're learning how to use computers in more connecting ways, more relationship ways. We're learning how to improve supply chains and not rely on moving things across continents. And these things will help, because this is going to happen again, but I don't think it's going to shut us down the way this one did, because we're adapting and overcoming. But you're going to, like, I used to tell people, you know, if you move to a neighborhood so that there won't be any violence and your kids will be safe, you're setting yourself up to be very disappointed, because safety is an emotion. It's not a physical place. And so I say the same thing. If you're trying really hard to get over this and thinking it'll never happen again, to protect yourself from the fear, you're going to be healthier if you say, even if it does happen again, I'm going to be okay. Mm-hmm. That's a better way to go. And that's that whole thing, grace in the space. I'm going to look at what I can control.
Yeah.
And that sometimes gets very, very, very small. I, you know, I'm not allowed to leave my house, and I'm not allowed to, you know, go see my friend for dinner. And well, I can put her on Zoom and we can cook the same meal and sit down at the table and eat, right? So you find ways. So I say to teachers, you guys know better than anybody, there are ways in your building to find new ways to feel like you have some control over things. You just can't look at the old ways. You have to build new ones.
That is pretty powerful. And I think that is a perfect way to wrap all of this up. Thank you so much for your time. I also just want to remind everyone that that's what this R&R space was created for, was connection and support and resources and community care for educators. So spread the word and bring a friend. We have
bring friends. Maybe, you know, now that you've had this guest speaker, I know the book study is also very fun. And although we, you know, I just kind of hit a tough thing to say, laughter is the best medicine, relationship heals, and that this team R&R thing is just a great place to hang out and a little, and maybe get some help. And so do invite your friends, because the more of them, then we can break into smaller groups and have much more of a discussion, kind of a forum. And I just really think we need each other right now very much.
I agree. I agree. Thank you. I can't wait to have you on again. And we have a couple of comments just saying, thank you so much, Dr. Seiden. Thanks, everyone. So we will see you at our next event. Thanks again.